Hello and welcome to Technically Legal's sixth podcast for July 7th, 2009. I'm Dominic Rabier, and with me today are...
Ben Snitkoff.
And David O'Brien.
We've got a nice selection of topics for you today. We're going to be talking about Google and any antitrust concerns that center around it. Website trade dress with regard to Kayak and Bing. The future of newspapers with copyright online. Developers and the GPL. And finally, NCAA basketball stars and trademark law. Let's dive right in with Google's antitrust concerns. Google is the world's leading search engine, and they're much more than a search engine, as they provide email, calendar services, photo sharing, blog reading, all sorts of documents. So their competitors are looking at Google and saying they pretty much own the market for search engines. Perhaps the Department of Justice should look into this. Are they the new Microsoft? Also, privacy groups are looking at Google and saying they've got a lot of information about a lot of people. What if some of that leaks? Let's tackle the antitrust question first. Ben or Dave, what are the antitrust concerns that the Department of Justice might raise about Google?
So one of the big concerns that they can raise is that Google has... they would argue, the DOJ would argue, that Google has market power in online advertisements, that they control so much of the online advertisement market that they can control what the price is for certain online ads, and that as a result they can use that market power to unduly influence the market, to change it from a competitive market to essentially a monopoly.
But in some sense, can't users go to any other search engine if they want to? I mean, nothing is really locking them into using Google. Google's market power, whatever it is very ephemeral. There is very little... I mean, it's very easy for users to use another search engine, isn't it?
It is, but that doesn't change the fact that Google has a huge grip on the market. It would have been very easy for people to switch from Microsoft Windows to Linux, but it didn't change the fact that back in the early 2000s, Microsoft had market power in that area of Windows-compatible PCs.
Well, just to point out quickly, there's nothing inherently wrong about having a monopoly. I mean, there are plenty of examples of monopoly situations that we see all over the place. A great example is certainly oil companies. You know, there's very few oil companies, actually more of an oligopoly, where you have just a few number of competitors in a very particular marketplace. What the problem is when a monopoly begins to exert its influence by way of its market power to sort of influence things, in this case, like ad revenue prices.
It should be emphasized that size alone is not a crime in the views of antitrust law. You can have the biggest corporation in the world, you can have a monopoly, and that's fine as long as they don't violate an antitrust law, which would be either by keeping other people out of the market through unfair trade practices or by engaging into some sort of exclusive agreement, a conspiracy in restraint of trade, to use the statutory language.
That makes sense. So Google, just by its size, doesn't hinge antitrust concerns, but it hasn't done anything that would fall under the anti-competitive behaviors, at least not yet. It seems like Google is pretty open with most of what it does.
Right. It did buy DoubleClick a few years back, and it's probably too late to do anything about that purchase now, but it's possible that that past purchase, in conjunction with, you know, some sort of questionable or actually illegal activity that they find now or in the future, could lead to a split up of Google or parts of Google. And that's radical, and there's very little basis for me to say that. Just, you know, holy conjecture, it's possible that Google size plus anti-competitive activities could result in that type of sanction.
Well, sure, and in addition, I mean, any of the proposed acquisitions or mergers that Google might be looking at could also implicate antitrust concerns. The most recent one was the Google and Yahoo deal, which was subject to the Department of Justice review. And basically, it's the Clayton Act is the controlling body of law here. And in the context of M&A, mergers and acquisitions, it generally applies to acquisitions that might substantially lessen competition or tend to create a monopoly in a particular area. And so Google has sort of changed its image from just a pure search engine over the years into really a content portal. They have acquired companies like YouTube, and they have gotten themselves into the online video business. In the end of the day, I mean, most of their revenue is based off of ad sales, and that's true, but they're also starting to control these other areas like email also, as they launch Gmail and things like that, their newsreader as well.
So one of the key arguments that Google's making is that the market power that they exert is, since their core business is advertising, their argument seems to be that they're actually a very small piece of the advertising business, because internet advertising competes with television advertising, with magazine advertising, with bus stop advertising, with those annoying flyers that they put on the windshield of your car advertising, and that Google's advertising is just a tiny piece of that market, and they don't really have that much market power. Is that a correct characterization of the market?
It's so hard to tell with these things. Defining what the market is an integral part of any antitrust litigation, and the courts will rule on either side of this. It's nearly impossible to guess how they'll rule. For instance, there was a recent case with Whole Foods. Whole Foods bought a competitor, or merged with a competitor, and the Department of Justice under the Bush administration challenged that merger as a violative of antitrust law. And in that case, a district court judge looked at that and said, no, it's not going to have a huge effect on the market because the market is all grocery stores. And then that went up to appeal in the D.C. Circuit, and the D.C. Circuit reversed that decision, saying that, you know, the relevant market may not just be grocery stores. It may be high-end natural foods grocery stores. And as a result, this could have an adverse effect on competition in that area. And they sent it back down to the district court. They actually sent it back down. They granted an injunction, technically. An injunction is an order to stop doing something, usually from a court, and the court essentially granted an injunction after the merger had taken place, and the court threw its arms up and said, "Yeah, we know we can't, you know, split you in two after you've already merged, but we can send it back down and make them reevaluate what they're doing and whether or not they should split off parts of it." So the market may be all of marketing, or the market may be internet marketing, and I think there's a strong argument, at least, that internet marketing is insular enough to constitute its own market.
I suppose, but you know, if we take a step back from this, and a lot of the models these days on the internet revolve around content production, and in the end of the day, it's about getting eyeballs onto your site. And once you get those eyeballs on your site, you have some hope that that people will be clicking on your ads, or at least seeing the ads, and that's what advertisers are paying for, and that's a lot of where Google's revenue actually comes from. So that alone, I mean, my point is that alone might constitute a bigger market. I think, as you mentioned, in just general internet advertising. Versus the alternative review, if you're splitting up the services and saying, well, yeah, Google has a search engine, they also have a video portal, they also have their news aggregator, and those constitute separate market segments. If you kind of step back and say, well, hey, you know, all the revenue that Google is basically getting is still based off of advertisements, and so they're finding new ways to sort of control the eyeballs that come onto their sites or come through their sites in some way.
Right now, Google is not under investigation by the Justice Department for anything pertaining to advertising. As far as we're aware, there are only three current government antitrust investigations, one about Google's hiring practices, along with other technology companies. There's a class action settlement with the Authors Guild with regard to Google's Books Project, and then the Federal Trade Commission is also looking into the connections between Google's board and Apple's board. Privacy groups also have trouble with Google. Their concerns are that since Google has so much information and so much of the market in internet services, a privacy leak, if something went wrong with Google, would expose millions of people's information to anyone who would access that leak. What are the privacy concerns that these groups, are they valid? Are they?
I think any privacy concern is going to be valid, especially in this market, and by market I mean environment. People's personal information leaks all the time. Very recently, I got a letter from my credit card company saying that my credit card had leaked, my credit card information had leaked, and they were sending me a new credit card. I could not find any more information on that. I couldn't figure out who had leaked my information. And this is information that I think I deserve to know, but the type of information that Google has about, you know, not only who you are, what your email address is, but your viewing habits, you know, your past Google searches. This is all very important and, frankly, possibly damaging information.
Well, beyond that, it's also very valuable information, too. So just by going and doing a search on Google, I mean, Google has basic access to your IP address. It knows the search terms that you're using. It knows what browser that you're using. It knows what operating system that you're using. And if you sort of combine all those elements, you really have a good idea of who is searching and, you know, what types of things they might be interested in. So that information is valuable then because they could sell that to people saying, we know that the people in Boston, for instance, are, you know, searching for personal injury attorneys, and, you know, they're doing it every Friday because they know the time and date that you're searching it. And they're, in conjunction with searching for personal injury attorneys, they're also searching for car sales or something like that. And I think that there's a lot that can happen with that information. And by visiting a lot of websites, you commonly find at the bottom of websites a privacy policy, which is effectively a contract to some extent. And just by using services, you're expressly agreeing to the terms of the privacy policy. And the privacy policy usually detail what information they're collecting, what they can do with the information, how they might be storing it, whether or not they could sell it to third parties. And very often it's the case that these companies are allowed to sell the information to third parties.
Right. An interesting side note to this is that if you go to the Google homepage, they had to change their page. I don't remember how long ago it was. It was fairly recently. At the very bottom of the line, the very bottom line of the page used to read copyright 2008-2009, then a dash in Google, and under California privacy law, they have to include the privacy notice on their homepage, so they changed the Google to a privacy. Just an example of Google doing something to comply with some of these laws. By the way, there are laws passed by many states to ensure how, to make sure that people understand how a company safeguards your data and to put in minimal standards for the safeguard of data.
Yep. And as a quick note, Google's web history, which keeps track of websites you visit and which search results you click on, you can actually turn that off in your Google account if you don't want Google to store that information, because it defaults to on. But that's pretty much enough about Google for today.
Well,
and
before I forget, I'm sorry to interject, but sure. Who could forget the AOL debacle when they made the search queries from individual users available, and it was millions of individual users, and oftentimes there was sort of embarrassing things that might have been searched for. So, you know, it's interesting that a lot of the time, despite some of the laws that are out there, this information still does get out, and it also legally gets out in some cases too.
Sounds good. So that's pretty much all we have on Google for today's podcast. Next, let's look at website trade dress. Microsoft search engine Bing, which aims to compete with Google, recently launched, and Bing has a travel search feature that looks awfully similar to Kayak's travel search. Kayak.com is a travel search engine that's been around for a couple of years, and Bing's travel search engine looks pretty much just the same. They've even almost chosen the same color scheme. Now, the important thing to note is that Microsoft did not license anything from Kayak to do this. Can they do this? If not, why not? If so, why can't they?
So I think the first thing we need to tackle is what exactly trade dress is. And so trademarks, we're all familiar with trademarks. It's the name of a brand, like Coca-Cola. When you walk into a store, you immediately identify the words Coca-Cola on a soda, and if you like Coca-Cola, you'll pick up that one instead of a similar one. But Coca-Cola not only has rights over the name, but also the look of its packaging, which is trade dress as opposed to trademark. Now, one very important distinguishing factor between trade dress and trademark, now that I think about it, it does apply to trademarks, although less so, and it's kind of a fuzzier application, but if something is functional, it can't be protected by trademark law, and specifically trade dress. So you can't trademark a specific handle on, say, a mug, because the handle serves a function. Unless the handle has some sort of form outside of its function, it's... Can anyone jump in and try to explain this a little more clearly than I am?
Sure. Well, trade dress basically protects the total image or overall appearance of a good, and that can actually also protect services. That can include things like the size, the shape, colors or color combinations, textures, graphics, and in some cases, particular sales techniques that are used. It's a bit of unsettled law at present. It's been expanding over the years. One of the big cases on it was a case called 2 pesos v. Taco Cabana. That's one that's commonly taught in law school in trademark classes. And it involved a taco restaurant, or actually two Mexican restaurants, which were eerily similar, I think, in appearances and colors. And sort of the essence of a trade dress claim is that customers have come to recognize the overall appearance of a particular good or service, and in their mind, they always associate it with a particular brand. And so when you have two things that look really similar, and you have one person that owns the trademark, and they've registered their trademark prior to the second person coming in and sort of copying it, it gives rise to a claim for trade dress under trademark law.
Right. One thing to note is that trade dress law usually falls under what's called the common law section of trademarks, because it's very hard to register trade dress. It's difficult to describe it in enough detail that people immediately know what that somebody who's reading the trademark registration would understand. So instead, they rely on the fact that people have seen it and they've gotten to know it and understand it. There are also two different sections to trade dress. There's product packaging, which is a box, and product design, which is the actual product itself. And there are slightly different standards that apply there.
So turning to the specifics of this case, Bing's search, which they didn't call Microsoft Kayak or anything, because that would have violated Kayak's trademark. But the trade dress, in other words, the look and feel of their website is very, very similar in terms of they've got the same layout, they've got the same colors, they've got the same sort of the way the gray left-hand column controls the sliders and the right column has the search results. So is Bing violating Kayak's trade dress?
Maybe. Another tough question here, because to the best of my knowledge, trade dress so far has not been extended to websites under a decision by any court. And I could be wrong, but that's to the best of my knowledge. The other two limitations, and Ben already discussed one of them, which is the functionality. So basically, trade dress won't, and trademark law in general, will not protect functional elements, and those are the types of things that can be considered essential to a particular use or purpose, something that might affect the overall cost or quality of an item, and it also can't be something that the exclusive use of a particular function would completely preclude other people from using the same type of functionality. And the second limitation is that you generally have to have secondary meaning. And what that means is that in the minds of the public, there has to be the actual look and feel of the product overall has to give some type of reason for the public to always associate those particular elements with
a good example
the brand.
A good example would be the shape of the Coca-Cola bottle, for example, attain secondary meaning because people can just see the silhouette of the bottle and immediately think Coca-Cola.
So getting back to Kayak, I think where those two limitations apply is, one, you have the ultimate question of is there actually some secondary meaning, meaning when someone goes to Kayak's website, do they always associate that layout with kayak.com? And the second is the functionality problems. So the use of and I would tell anyone who's listening to go check out the two websites if you can. Get two browsers up, put them side by side, do searches in each browser, and check out how similar the results are. And so the use of the sliders and stuff are really functional elements, and maybe to some extent some of the placement of, say, the results and stuff are somewhat functional. Maybe trade dress would still apply to the other parts of the overall layout, which are not functional in nature. So it's, you know, in my opinion, it's a little undetermined whether or not this is going to qualify for trade dress protection.
Yeah, I think Dave hit the nail on the head there. The inquiry, the court's decision, if a case actually ever comes of this, is going to hinge on whether or not this is functional, whether or not, you know, there's having the site set up like this confers a certain benefit, be it financial or ease of use on the customers who are using the site. That's going to be determinative of which way this decision goes.
Any predictions in terms of which way this decision might go? And just to note that Kayak has contacted Microsoft through official channels, and they're discussing, but we don't know what, if anything, will come of it.
I don't know. I you know, they are so eerily similar. It, even from a non-legal perspective, it's hard to say that these two designs are not so close that there is some type of legal culpability in there. It's sort of going to depend, of course, on what Ben said, on the functionality of the elements. But I would kind of like to think that a court would be willing to extend trade dress protection, even if it's some limited form of trade dress protection, to the overall layout and design. But I guess we'll see.
Yeah, my prediction would be that the court would find in favor of Microsoft, if only because the functionality protection, it's a really hard test to apply because it can be so broad. There's one case where a court determined that it was functional to have scented candles be laid out in a kind of like a home-like atmosphere with natural wood shelving and with pictures of soothing things on the front of the candles. That's functional because it helps to sell these things. It helps to sell the candles. So what I described sounded like a Yankee candle company store with, you know, all the natural wood and stuff, but it wasn't. This was another company who was selling their own scented candles with, you know, similar packaging and a similar environment, and the court said, yeah, it's functional because that's, you know, it's necessary or it helps to sell these candles. And you can't get trade dress protection over something like that. And I think it's broad enough that in this case it would move to include the elements of the website that we see. I think I have to wonder if there's a copyright infringement claim, though.
Yes, that's exactly what I was just going to bring up, too. Because I think, I mean, there's trade dress law, of course, and that's trademark law, but copyright protection, as we've talked about many times before in the past, extends to original expression that's fixed in some sort of tangible medium. And that it has been extended in the past to design layouts for certain things. In copyright law, facts are not copyrightable. And so any of the factual elements, for instance, the actual search results themselves, I think both sites, I might be wrong here, but both sites are basically aggregators of other travel websites in the end of the day. And they're showing travel schedules and prices of flights between areas. And of course, copyright is also subject to the same functionality limitation that trademark is, and you can't copyright functional elements. So similar to trademark, you know, as we've sort of hit on here, the functional parts of the website wouldn't be protected, but the design layout still might be protected. And I'm not really sure, but it would definitely extend to any of the code that's used to generate the site. I am kind of wondering, though, if it's a little bit less of a standard, because for copyright infringement, you're using the substantial similarity standard. And so it might be that the code doesn't have to be exact, but if it's close enough in terms of the design layout, it might still constitute a copyright infringement. Any thoughts?
That's true, but there's also the same limitation with functional code. It's a very complicated thing.
But you're right, but it would still protect the ultimate expression, though, of the code. And
I
think if the code is expressed in a substantially similar way,
I think you'd have to copy the code wholesale for that to trigger.
Yes.
You couldn't, you know, come to the same conclusion as the code. You couldn't have code that, you know, looks similar to it. if you want to have a successful copyright claim, there would have to either be wholesale copying of the code, or if they sat down with the Kayak code and, you know, transcribed it into whatever Microsoft's using, .asp files as opposed to Perl or whatever Kayak's using.
Ajax, I think.
Ajax.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. See, I might beg to differ there a little bit, because I think that the test is pretty clearly, as far as I know, substantial similarity. And you've got the code, even it's substantially similar, and it's producing a very similar result. And the layout of the frames is very similar, and I don't know that you would actually need to have an exact copying to still be an infringement.
That almost gets into sort of a reverse engineering sort of situation where you have different code creating a very similar or same result. And because of the nature of how copyright interacts with software, you're not going to see a copyright claim sustained on that, because if the code producing it creates this even a similar looking thing, but the code is different and it's proven that there was no copying, then there's probably not going to be a successful copyright claim coming from that.
Right. So copyright infringement involves copying and substantial similarity. So there has to be an act of... this is confusing. So it has to be copied from an original work, but that copying can be proven by substantial similarity.
Right.
And at the
however,
same time, you can prove that... sorry, you were saying, Dominic?
However, in this situation, you've got two works, if you will. You've got the code itself, which is a work, and then you've got that which the code produces, the visual layout of the website, which is another second work that just happens to be produced by the first work. Now, you can apply substantial similarity and say, aha, these two works, these two website layouts, they are substantially similar. However, if you go then look at the code that produces these two, and you see that the code that produced these website layouts is not substantially similar and isn't a copy, then you're not going to be able to maintain a copyright infringement claim, because since the second work is produced by the first work, and if the first work doesn't have copying, therefore the second work can't have copying. You would have to resort to trade dress protection, not copyright protection, for the website layout.
Yes.
And I think we've pretty much talked this topic in sufficient detail. So let's head over to our next topic, which is the future of newspapers and copyright online, which was, I think David noticed, a blog post by Judge Posner, in which he had a very interesting closing that I'm just going to read wholesale. The context is talking about newspapers in the internet era, and Judge Posner is arguing basically that the online provision of news has made newspapers much harder for them to make money, and in some sense, perhaps the law should change to help newspapers make money so that people can't just link to news or copy-paste the important part of news instead, so that newspapers somehow make money. The line in question is that, quote, expanding copyright law to bar online access to copyrighted materials without the copyright holder's consent, or to bar linking to or paraphrasing copyrighted materials without the copyright holder's consent, might be necessary to keep free riding on content financed by online newspapers from so impairing the incentive to create costly news gathering operations that the news services like Reuters and the AP would be the only professional non-governmental sources of news and opinion, end quote. So what are your guys' thoughts on this? Is it correct to argue that the law should potentially change?
Well, let me just first start off by saying I have a lot of respect for Judge Posner. Judge Posner is a Seventh Circuit judge, and up until just a few years ago, he was actually the chief Seventh Circuit judge, and he's enjoyed a lot of fame for some of his decisions, and very well respected. I've liked reading a lot of his decisions. They're always well reasoned. And of course, you know, as we already noted, this came up in a blog post. It wasn't actually in a decision. But I get a lot of problems with what he said. First off, he spent most of the post, the vast majority of the post, talking about the downturn of the newspaper industry. And I think we're talking here about the paper newspaper industry, not the online ones. And you know, he cites some interesting figures. He talks about overall newspaper decline, and he talks about the economic downturn hurting the newspaper ad revenues overall, and then eventually gets into this thing where he thinks we should bar online access or stop people from linking and riding on free content. And one of his basic premises is that content, meaning like news postings, are freely available online. And while that's certainly true, I can't help but just sit there and wonder how much of the current problems that the newspaper has gotten is really more of the result of everything shifting over to our now digital world. And I sort of like to think that the newspapers have just done a very poor job about moving themselves over into the online space. They were not quick to get themselves online, and they couldn't think of quick ways to monetize the business itself. And there's a lot of benefits that the online news industry has provided. I almost exclusively use online news sources now, and I rarely will I pick up a paper newspaper anymore. Anyways, I think that Judge Posner is sort of grasping onto this world that is inevitably going to fail, and that any type of expansive protection that we give to newspapers is really, it's really not going to help the way that the industry is shifting. And on top of that, you have the policy arguments behind copyright. Copyright was enumerated in what's known as the Intellectual Property Clause of the Constitution, and it within that clause, it actually provides certain limitations on the types of things that can be protected under copyright. And then in the statute itself and through judicial doctrine over the last 100 years or so, we've seen the concept of fair use, which basically says that there are certain uses which are inherently non-infringing, where you have them for purposes of newspaper commentary and transformative uses, and there are a bunch of other factors that we don't really need to get into. But in other words, it's been okay for people to quote small excerpts, to comment on them, to provide types of critical commentary. And it seems that he wants to do away with that online. And it's not really clear what he means by it when he says bar access to online work, because there are already remedies at law where you have copyright infringement. A content holder, a copyright holder, can still commence a legal action against somebody that is potentially infringing their work and seek to have it taken down or go after them for damages and stuff. So I don't know that there's all that much to be gained by expanding copyright at law to bar access to certain types of works or to prevent people from linking, and it seems to impinge on First Amendment rights as well. What do you guys think?
I think my first comment is that he doesn't seem to be suggesting as radical a change in copyright law as I think people may read on the first go. Rather, he's suggesting that newspapers radically change the way they approach online media, because copyright law already can bar access to online copyrighted materials without the holder's consent. You can already sue people for posting your content without your consent if they're copying it, making it available, but publishing it to others. So that in particular doesn't worry me. What worries me is what Dave was saying earlier, that he's also suggesting that if you put it online, barring making it illegal to link to that copyrighted material or paraphrasing the copyrighted material, doesn't seem to comport with the First Amendment. There's some debate as to whether or not fair use is a First Amendment requirement or just a statutory requirement. It is in statute, but it was not initially in the statute. The judges made the fair use doctrine before it was written in by Congress, so people don't know if it's necessarily a constitutional right. If inherent in the First Amendment is this right to use other people's work or to discuss other people's work in a critical fashion.
So just to play devil's advocate for a moment and kind of put myself in Posner's shoes, if I could even think to do that, one of the things that he might be concerned about, and he doesn't expressly mention this in the posting, but maybe it's the fact that once somebody has borrowed your content, and just because of the fast nature of news, once it's been posted, the damage has already been done there. And there are, even though you still have actions at law to go after the alleged infringers, the damage has happened, your news is getting misappropriated by somebody else and copied over, and that's why we should have some sort of bar on, making certain types of news content available online or linking out.
To take a step back, do online services free ride on newspapers' content?
I don't think so. So much. I mean, it's not that. I mean, it's always on a case by case basis.
Like, look at Google News, for example. Like, if you go to Google News, you've got a list of top stories with links to various newspapers, with the headlines provided by Google. I don't think there's advertising on Google News' main page. I'm not sure.
I think there's a little bit, but not with everything on Google, they try to minimize it. But I think that's a different situation overall, because they're linking out. They're still driving traffic to certain websites. Whether or not they're driving traffic to websites which are hosting infringing content is perhaps a different question. But I don't see that the aggregation of news links is being all that evil. Another thing, though, is that these days, and I was talking with Ben about this last week, you can see the same story basically pop up on 8 different news websites, and that's because so many people these days use AP reports, the Associated Press-generated reports, the Reuters stuff. It gets syndicated across everything, and in some cases properly licensed, and maybe in other cases not so. But the stories are very much the same. There's not a lot of deviation from the facts.
Well, one would hope the facts wouldn't vary depending on which source was reporting.
Well, you get that's, I guess, the difference between news reporting and news opinion pieces. But even so, you're seeing the same content splashed around everywhere.
Agreed.
But copyright law doesn't actually protect the news itself. Again, like the actual factual circumstances of what happened, it only protects the expression thereof, right?
That's right. And what I mean is that they're actually wholesale using the AP report as it is expressed in words. Sometimes you'll see like an extra paragraph or two added in the front or at the end or sometimes in the middle, but for the most part it's like a pure AP news story.
But these newspapers are posting this news online for free. Well, free so much as they're still advertising on their site. But they're providing it available. There's only the only newspaper that I can think of that actually succeeds in charging for its content is the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
And I personally remember getting really annoyed with them because I could read an article if I clicked through via Google, but then I couldn't read through it if I went to the link normally, or it didn't seem to make sense to me the way that things were set up.
There's so much benefit, though, from the standpoint of the newspapers if they were to get all their stuff online. So I think one of the problems that they've had from a business standpoint in the past is that they make a ton of money. Well, at least they were making a lot of money. A substantial amount of their revenues were based on advertising sales. But when you put stuff in print form and people buy subscriptions, you don't know who's looking at the ads, who's actually buying stuff from the ads. And so there was a lot of uncertainty there. But when you put everything online, sort of similar to some of the Google stuff we talked about with privacy concerns, you get much more information about who is viewing the story, in some cases how long they were viewing the story for, and then if they were clicking through on the ads, if they didn't click through on the ads, and that sort of stuff. And so I think, to some extent, there's more value in having it online than there is in having it in print form. I don't know how much money they were actually making in the past off of their subscription-based fees for paper printing. Generally, it's pretty cheap. I think the Wall Street Journal is one of the more expensive ones. And last time I had a subscription to them, it was probably about $100 or $150 a year at like a student rate. But that probably doesn't cover very much of their overhead costs in the end of the day, and most of their revenues are based off of advertising anyways.
Just to close out with a quick discussion on the bar that on linking that Posner considers, should there be such a bar that you can't link to me without my permission?
I think that's absurd. If you put something online, you can't expect people to not link to it without your permission. If you're putting it online for free, what's the point in barring linking like that?
Well, we want you to come through our main page of our site, go see our ads on the first page, and then click through our navigation so you keep seeing ads on every page. It's the same reason that websites will sometimes paginate an article into 12 pages so that each time you click onto a new page, you get a fresh set of ads that you could potentially click on.
Right, and I understand the desire to have more ad clicks, but I don't understand how you would make a enforceable copyright regime around preventing what's called deep linking, you know, linking mm-hmm. to a page that's not the main page. And if nothing else, it puts a huge tax on being able to disseminate information to people.
Free speech? Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, as much as I'm hesitant to raise a free speech argument in something like that, that's incredibly burdensome on being able to discuss things online, especially if you then add Posner's retraction of fair use. If you can't paraphrase an article, if you can't quote from an article, and you can't link directly to an article, how are you going to talk to anybody about something online?
And what happens? You get their permission first, they charge you a license fee, you pay it, and then you can talk about it freely after you've paid them whatever fee they want.
I guess. Is that really practical in the end of the day, though, with the nature of how fast news is and how fast news gets out on the
internet? Well, the government could mandate some sort of centrally controlled microtransaction thing, the Office of Information Propagation or something like that. Create some jobs.
Furthermore, how far does that reach? Would it keep me from linking an article to somebody in a instant message chat, or only on blogs, only on commercial sites? It doesn't seem like a reasonable scheme to do anything useful.
It just seems to frustrate the underlying purpose of the Copyright Act as it exists today, and I don't see that it's very practical, and frankly, I don't really see the point of it either, because the newspaper entities, although they are in very tough times now, we've seen a lot of bankruptcy filings. Even the heralded New York Times, which has been, you know, one of the number one, I think it's the number one distributed newspaper across the United States, has even cited really tough times in terms of its revenue. But I think that if as the years go on, hopefully these newspaper entities will find a way to get their content online in a way where they're making money and also create efficiencies.
Sounds good. There's obviously a lot more to talk about on this issue, but we'll move on for now. The last story that we're going to cover today is a quick take on developers and the GPL, the GNU Public License. There was a very well-written essay posted on a developer's blog that we're going to link to in the show notes, and he basically argues that the GPL restricts creativity in some sense because commercial software owners can't really touch GPL's code because of the way the GPL works. It has this viral nature where if something is incorporated if you have a commercial product and then you incorporate some GPL code into your product, that GPL code can effectively infect your code, and thus you have to relicense the entirety of your product with now the embedded GPL code as GPL, or risk violating the terms of the GPL license. The uncertainties around this embedding mean that commercial software developers tend to avoid using the GPL as much as possible. I can speak from personal anecdotal experience working in the legal department at a commercial software developer. The way that particular developer worked, we tried to avoid any GPL code at all in our code simply because the legal uncertainties meant that we didn't want to risk having to expose the source code of our product if we had GPL, and that's a pretty common view for most commercial software developers. Microsoft does not use, for example, any GPL code. The article in question basically distinguishes between the GPL and more liberal licenses, such as the MIT license, which enable commercial software developers to incorporate so-called free code into their products, build on it, and then sell it without necessarily needing to give away the source code along with it, even though they did start from free use source code. It's a really good article that's well worth a read, and since we're running a bit short on time, let's keep a quick discussion on any thoughts on the GPL and the way it works.
One thing I'll say is that so far the GPL has evaded any serious judicial review, which, while good in that it's good in that the GPL still has legs. People are still scared about misusing GPL code. The flip side of that is people don't know the extent of the code or what kind of damages they'll face if they breach the code, whether it'll be copyright infringement, whether there'll be contract remedies for breach of a license agreement, essentially. You know, whether they'll just have to pay money to the GPL and stop using the code, or whether they'll actually have to open up their code and give it to people. And that ambiguity, I think, is more dangerous than the GPL itself. The fact that people don't know the extent of it, they don't know how far the license goes, I don't know how much of an actual effect restraint on use, restraint on looking at this code and reusing the code it's actually having, or restraint on development of things relating to the code. But regardless of what effect the GPL would have on reuse of the code, the ambiguity in the GPL as to how it would be enforced has a whole nother level of restraint on how people use the GPL.
David, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of benefits to why people want to have something like the GPL, and it's obviously one of them. One of the biggest ones is the fact that the source code gets opened up. People can freely modify it and create derivative works from it, tweak it as far as their desire, to incorporate changes into it for their own personal uses, share those uses with other people, and the people that are creating these modifications and changes, when they do it, they want to see the changes freely available to everybody. They don't want the big companies coming in and just snatching up their source and then using it in whole or using it in part and incorporating it into their own proprietary software. I certainly do recognize, though, that the frustration that a lot of developers are seeing with the uncertain aspects has been discussed, and it's a little unfortunate that some parts of it are so contentious and that there is so much fear-mongering about, you know, what happens when you use a portion of code that's been licensed under the GPL, but I guess we'll just have to see what happens. Inevitably, there's going to be some lawsuit that, you know, tries to challenge the GPL on its merits, and we'll find out what the actual remedies will be in the end.
Sounds good. And we're not going to cover our last story on the NCAA basketball stars. However, the link will be in the show notes, and we'll probably do a blog post about it at some point in later on. Thanks for listening this week. And once again, I'm Dominic Rupp, and with me are
Ben Snitkoff
and David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening, and hope to see you again next week for another edition of Technically Legal. Have a great week. Take care.